I'm Al Filreis, and this is Poem Talk at the Writer's House, where I have the pleasure of convening three friends in the world of contemporary poetry and poetics to collaborate on a close but not too close reading of a poem. We'll talk, maybe even disagree a bit, and perhaps open up the verse to a few new possibilities, and we hope gain for a poem that interests us some new readers and listeners. And I say listeners because Poem Talk poems are available in recordings made by the poets themselves as part of our Penn Sound archive, writing.upenn.edu/Penn Sound. Today, I'm joined here, happily, in Philadelphia, at the Kelly Writer's House in our third floor Garrett studio by Herman Beavers, scholar, critic, teacher, and poet, whose most recent poems have appeared in Melis, the Langston Hughes Colloquy, and Versadelphia, who teaches, among other things, of course, on the literatures of jazz. Both undergrad and graduate chair of Africana Studies here at Penn, and a longtime friend of the Writer's House, and indeed a member of our advisory board. And by Salamisha Tillett, also a colleague here at Penn, author of Sites of Slavery, Citizenship, and Racial Democracy in the Post-Civil Rights Imagination, who has guest blogged for The Nation magazine and has appeared on CNN, MSNBC, NPR, composer of the liner notes for a Grammy-winning John Legend in the Roots album, and co-founder of A Long Walk Home Incorporated, a nonprofit org using art therapy to help end violence against girls and women. And by Kathy Lou Schultz, whose books of poems include Some Vague Wife, Genealogy, and Redress, with a book of prose published by Belladonna called Biting Midge, and a critical book on the Afro-modernist epic about Tolson, Hughes, and Baraka, who teaches at the University of Memphis and hails from South Dakota and then Nebraska, and then in one great phase of her life, this very Kelly Writer's House. Welcome back home, Kathy Lou.
It's great to be here. Thanks, Al.
I'm excited to have everybody. I've really been looking forward to this confabulation. Herman, good to see you.
Good to be here, Al.
Salamisha, thanks for making the trip down from New York for us.
Oh, you're welcome. This is fun.
So today we're here, the four of us, to talk about a super famous, widely anthologized poem by Claude McKay called If We Must Die. It was written in 1919 after the Red Scare and the so-called Red Summer of race riots in cities across the U.S. and first published in a leftist journal, one almost says, wants to say communist journal, above an article about Bolshevism and religion. We have a recording of the poet reciting this poem, so here now is Claude McKay performing If We Must Die.
If We Must Die is the poem that makes me a poet among colored Americans. If we must die, let it not be like hogs, hunted and penned in an inglorious pot, while round us bark the mad and hungry dogs, making their mock at our accursed lot. If we must die, oh, let us nobly die, so that our precious blood may not be shed in vain. Then even the monsters we defy shall be constrained to honor us, though dead. O kinsmen, we must meet the common foe, though far outnumbered, let us show us brave, and for their thousand blows deal one death blow. What though before us lies the open grave? Like men, we'll face the murderous, cowardly pack, pressed to the wall, dying but fighting back.
I think all of us know this poem really well, so I'm really looking forward to this, and I'm not sure where we're going to start. I'm just going to take a shot at it, and we'll go in whatever direction. So why don't I just ask Herm to start with. We have some evidence of an address. The speaker is addressing a seemingly specific audience. You want to take a first crack at the addressee?
I'm always struck by the manner in which this is. There's a sense of finality to the speech of the speaker in the poem. That this is
his last words,
a last stand. Mm-hmm. The what you say before you're about to make a last stand, and given that the historical context of the poem is that he's addressing the race riots and the lynchings in the post-World War I mm-hmm. moment, you sort of have to ask the question about what he sees on the other side of the confrontation. So it's not a citizenship poem.
Great. Kathy Lou, so follow that and tell us what evidence we have in the poem of the address. Who's being addressed?
I think that the historical location of the poem is extremely important, as Herman Beaver said, that 1919, following the red summer of all the death that happened and following World War One, it's interesting to me that at this moment of protest that he would choose the sonnet as his form of protest at that particular moment. And I'm very interested in the sonnet as an enclosure or constraint versus the sonnet as a protest or freedom.
So he certainly makes the formal choice of the sonnet. What kind of sonnet? Is it a Petrarchan sonnet or a Shakespearean sonnet?
Well, he's writing in the English tradition, right? So as an inheritor of that tradition through being a Black British subject, right?
Jamaican.
And he writes... In 1953, he says that education, that enculturation was so successful, he says that we really believe we were little Black Britons, right?
So you're going to say a Shakespearean sonnet.
Right, a Shakespearean sonnet.
With the couplet at the end.
Yeah.
And you guys are so great, except I still haven't gotten an answer to the question about where's the evidence in the poem for the address. Salamisha?
Well, I mean, I think I agree with everyone that the historical context of the poem matters, and therefore we read it as African-American subjects that he's speaking to, and particularly African-American men, right? I think this is very much a poem in response to African-American soldiers coming back from World War One, on one hand, and at the same time, trying to galvanize communities of African-Americans who are experiencing death blows across the country. But what I think is fascinating about the poem is the ambiguity of who he's addressing. And I think there's a lot of debate about the racial specificity on one hand and then the appeal to universality on the other hand. But I think by having it ambiguous, I think he's making a kind of different citizenship claim. I think we understand it's African-Americans, and through that we can then look out broader and think, well, these are African-American subjects that we're talking about, but this poem or this we can apply to so many different subjects, right?
So there's a we.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, it's fine.
So there's a we.
Mm-hmm.
If we must die, we're the ones who could die.
Yep.
And then there's a you, and who are the you in the poem? There's an indication of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say that the subject is, the we is a bit broader. I mean, it definitely has an African-American context, but I think for McKay, having that Afro-diasporic consciousness, right, that it's not just Blacks in America, but globally, that there's this joining of race consciousness in the sense that this is a moment at which a stand must be taken. So he's looking at, I would say, in a diasporic context, he's looking at forces of colonialism. You know, in America, he's looking at Jim Crow and the legacy of slavery. So it's those ranges of systems that institutionalize the violence and oppression that he's addressing.
So, Herm, who are the kinsmen? I mean, Salamisha just suggested, I think everybody agrees, that it's not clear. But what are some options? What are some nominations for who? We know we're pretty settled on we, although it's shifting because of the use of the sonnet. But who are the kinsmen?
Well, you have to remember when this was written. And kinsmen, I agree with Kathy Lou, that there's a very Pan-Africanist cast to the poem. Because you have to sort of ask yourself the question, what does it mean for a Jamaican immigrant to come to the United States and so thoroughly identify with Black Americans being lynched that he would write this poem? And so on some level, what gives weight to what he's saying would be, I think, the colonial context.
If we must die, oh, let us nobly die, so that our precious blood may not be shed in vain. Then even the monsters we defy shall be constrained to honor us, though dead. O kinsmen, we must meet the common foe.
I was thinking about the idea of the collective. So on one end, I agree with the Afro-diasporic consciousness or collectivity that he's appealing to, but I'm also thinking of the publication history, right? And so that it was published in this kind of leftist magazine
that wasn't
really read by African-Americans, but it gets republished in magazines and periodicals that African-Americans are reading. So on one hand, I think there's a kind of like a shift in the poem. Like in the beginning, I think the staunch rallying cry is to African-Americans, but then also to the larger African diasporic Afro-Caribbean community. But then I wonder if there's like a, with the kinsman word in particular, right? So there's a way in
it's
which...
Is it a little troubling, the kinsman word, at all?
No. What?
No?
Why is it?
I don't know. I'm just asking.
You mean in terms of gender or just in terms of like, well, if there's something that it brings up for you?
Not when you consider that it's a Shakespearean sonnet.
That's what I'm going for.
The word kinsman does resonate in the Anglo-British context.
Mm-hmm. Shakespeare wrote so beautifully or troublingly about the green sceptered isle, and mm-hmm. those kinsmen would have mm-hmm. been bound by nation. Mm-hmm. And McKay's borrowing that formal strategy for a very different kind of struggle. And mm-hmm. you know, here's the time when we bring in something we all know, sort of, which is that apparently or allegedly Winston Churchill read the poem mm-hmm. on the radio during the siege of London by the Blitzkrieg, or sorry, not the Blitzkrieg, but the Luftwaffe, the air, in 1940 at the lowest moment. And he summoned this poem as a Shakespearean moment to rally the Brits. And because there's no specific racial marker in the poem by language, he gets away with that. Mm-hmm. McKay apparently thought that was great, at least later. Other poets like Melvin Tolson were really troubled by that. Can we talk about this? And Solomisha reminded me before we went on the air that it's not even clear that Churchill did this. There's really no record of it.
Yeah, the Churchill Center released a report in 2012 saying that there is no record of it. So it is like an urban myth, or just a myth, not an urban myth.
Well, you know, I when you scan the poem, I wonder if we could hear the Churchill recording where the stresses would fall in Churchill's reading compared to where they fall in McKay's reading, because there are a lot of trochaic feet in the poem. Mm-hmm. And so when I think about that, it's almost as if he's making... Now, you always find sort of trochaic shifts in sonnets. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's what poets do. But there are a number of sort of duple and triple feet in the poem that I think are there intentionally to sort of shift the poem off its sort of Shakespearean sonnet center, where it's perfect iambic pentameter. The sort of metrical shifts to me are indicative of the poem as protest, and so it's formally protesting against what the Shakespearean sonnet does, which is why I'd be interested to hear the Churchill recording, because I think politically there's stuff going on in the poems, the metrics that we need to think about.
Can we talk about the politics of the sonnet, the politics of the formal choice of the sonnet? There's a point of view that says, for all of the content radicalism of Claude McKay, who did join the Jamaican Communist Party, not the U.S. Communist Party, who at one point, probably at the time he was writing this, was very politically radical. And this, after all, is about counterviolence, justification of counterviolence. But there is a strain of thought, and I think Tolson shared it, that suggests that it's a radical content, but a conservative form. You want to take that on, Kathy Lou?
Well, I think that if we understand the sonnet more broadly as a form that's transnational, beginning in Italy, then being transported to England and France and throughout Europe, and then being inherited by American mm-hmm. writers, that the sonnet itself isn't as unitary in representing a certain kind of cultural cachet, right? That it's already traveled throughout centuries and across nation states.
So he's, in a sense, liberating the sonnet from that.
I think that he is, and he's a complex character in his relationship to audience, his relationship to the black literary elite, even those who would later claim him. He writes in a letter to Langston Hughes that he cared more about the response of radicalist leftist readers of publications like The Masses and Liberator, more so than he did about the black literary elite. So the poem has this kind of shape-shifting, even though it's made to represent certain kinds of moments at certain times.
Herm, your thought on this?
You know, I'm thinking about Jay Saunders Redding's book, To Make a Poet Black, and he's pretty hard on McKay.
Yeah.
In that book. And one of the things that he says
is, "To Make a Poet Black" is a line from Cullen, who is also accused of being formally conservative.
Yes, and one of the things he says about McKay is that McKay's formal technique is slipshod.
Including this poem?
Yeah, and so...
Oh, I don't think I agree with that.
I don't either, but it's interesting because Redding was a sort of formalist. Yeah. So he was very hard. He was very hard on everybody. I mean, nobody survives to make a poet black. I think maybe Hughes gets a sort of half nod, but Sterling Brown, who knew metrics backward and forward, he's very hard on Sterling A. Brown. So when you think about that, I mean, I keep thinking that the sonnet as this sort of problem-solving poetic form, where you're working through a problem, this poem quickly dispenses with that imperative.
Solomon, I'm going to try something out on you and just choose to go somewhere else with it if you don't want to deal with this. But I'm very interested in O Kinsman, which I think we the four of us have given a good reading of. But to complicate it, I've heard people say, and I've at some time or other believed, that it's a very strategic misaddressing, that it, in a way, by using the sonnet in particular, that McKay is strategically addressing the readers of anthologies, mostly a white readership, that he is addressing those who are not part of the conflict, that he is really pushing the poem out there, especially by using the missile of the sonnet, or the launching vehicle, mm-hmm. The delivery vehicle is the phrase I'm looking for, of the sonnet, to allow the poem to get beyond where it would be constrained by using the Shakespearean sonnet, by doing it so well, despite Reading. What do you make of that idea that McKay may be embedding a white addressee in this perfect sonnet?
Yeah, I mean, I think the O Kinsman and then the shift to We Must Meet the Common Foe actually, I mean, rereading this poem and in this conversation has me thinking that maybe the first half of the poem is about an African-American, an Afro-diasporic addressee, but that the shift, and I don't necessarily think it's a bad thing to kind of, if you open up the readership, then you may be opening up who can be part of a radical movement to end
an alliance, maybe
common foe. Racism or colonialism, right? Yeah. So that I think that's where the liberator readers actually get drawn into the poem, but also are part. They're not necessarily they're not the people out, you know, participating in the race riots. They're the people that may be able to help galvanize a kind of moral conscience against such troubles.
Great, thank you for going along with that. Any any other further thoughts
on
that?
Well, you know, this poem, it occurs to me, functions in the same tradition as David Walker's The Appeal.
Yes.
Which is written in a mode of address that's supposedly aimed at black readers, but he had to have known that whites would have been reading that given what happened to him, he had to have known that whites would have been reading The Appeal. And so by virtue of that, I think that McKay is using a very similar strategy, even though the mode of address might be black folks in Mississippi or mm-hmm. Alabama. He's aware of the fact that it's an important thing for white readers to see that blacks are not going to take this behavior lying down.
It's mm-hmm. also important for white readers to read a poem that has such radical content, but perfects a tradition that they had thought was theirs.
Right.
The Shakespearean sonnet. Mm-hmm. So it, in a way, proves, right, Kathy Liu, yeah. that, you know, I am a radical mm-hmm. and I am a person of color,
right.
but I'm writing in the great Shakespearean tradition. If you mess with me, you're messing with that tradition.
Right. And I think that
your own tradition.
That we too narrowly define the choices that black poets can or should make, you know, because for McKay, of course, the sonnet is part yeah. of his tradition,
yeah.
right? Growing yeah. up in Jamaica yeah. and in the British schooling system. So it's, you know, once you've seen the English sonnet, you're supposed to unsee it, and you can only write in some other form that is yeah. supposed to be correct for a black poet.
But there are some who would have argued that.
Yeah, well, it's ironic, I think, that Melvin Tolson, writes a review saying, you know, calling McKay to account for this kind of conservatism in terms of form, because these are the kinds of arguments that are repeated again and again. Tolson is the guy who gets beat up for decades for supposedly having outpounded Pound, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, Pound is as much his inheritance as his ancestors from Africa or Asia. I mean, he claims this broad lineage as well.
But I also think he gets critique from both sides. So with Tolson, it may be about form. But then mm-hmm. Brathwaite, I know, also critiqued him for content, that this was actually too narrow, that yeah. this appeal to a kind of racial consciousness really compromised his aesthetic. So, I mean,
right.
it's interesting.
And that would have been a bit of anti-communism.
Anti-communism, probably. But also inheriting the sonnet form as right. your tradition, mm-hmm. and therefore McKay's compromising it by making this kind of appeal to anti-racism, yeah. right? So it's just really interesting who owns the sonnet, and then right. once you understand that yeah. you own it, what you can do with it.
Yeah. Why not, let me read the first couple of paragraphs from Tolson's review, which is 1954, so it's well after this. Then I'm going to invite each of you to comment on that in any way you want, and then we'll wrap up by each of us just saying one more thing about this poem. So here's Tolson's review in Poetry Magazine. During the last World War, Sir Winston Churchill snatched Claude McKay's poem, If We Must Die, snatched is a loaded word there, mm-hmm. from the closet of the Harlem Renaissance, closet is a loaded word, and paraded in it before the House of Commons as if it were a talismanic uniform of His Majesty's Field Marshal. Ouch. The double signature of the roll would not have gone undeciphered by the full-blooded African poet who could avouch, in spite of apartheid, quote, I have never regarded myself as a Negro poet. I have always felt that my gift of song was something bigger than the narrow limits of any people and its problems, unquote. And yet in the sestet of the Negro's tragedy, with its passive voice becoming an artery for an active idea, McKay declares the poetry, quote, is urged out of my blood, and then his raw, taut finality bristles in the monosyllables, there is no white man who could write my book, unquote. Boy, is that complicated. Who wants to start on that one? Herm, take a shot.
Well, you know, he's in a tough position because there is
Tolson
not...
Tolson or McKay?
McKay is in a tough position. We are probably about 3 years from Langston Hughes's The Weary Blues, somewhere thereabouts. So the blues poem hasn't come to the fore yet, which to me is one of the first purely African American forms to enter into American poetics. Mm-hmm. So he gets it. I agree with Salamichi. He gets it from both sides.
Yeah.
And the thing is, you could really ask the question, why in the midst of something so horrific didn't you come up with a form of your own to really sort of match that situation? But I don't think it's fair to say that. On the other hand, this does anticipate what's going to happen in the late 50s and early 60s as African-American poets are responding to the violence that goes along with the civil rights movement. Mm-hmm. And so what it raises as a question to me is writing a poem in a situation like that driven by issues of form, or is it driven by issues of sentiment and emotion? And it could be that, you know, the way that McKay covered himself with regard to the emotional content is to leave aside those questions about form.
Interesting. I mean, Tolson is probably unintentionally evincing a racial essentialism when saying, how could a poem be written urged out of my blood and be a sonnet?
Mm-hmm.
And I think what Kathy Lou is saying is, if you're Jamaican, then both those conditions are possible. Kathy Lou, your response to Tolson, you know Tolson very well.
Yeah, so the review is 54, and yeah. Tolson's libretto for the Republic of Liberia comes out in 1953, which is one of his long epic poems and one
modernist.
Of the least read, yes. And so Tolson is in the process from the 40s on of writing himself into the modernist canon, as he understands it. And I wonder if in this review, the point of his critique is more towards Churchill in some way as sort of donning a garment, right, that's been created by this Jamaican poet, right? So that it wasn't Churchill's to snatch, right? That it wasn't his, which kind of turns on turns against the idea of the sonnet being the property of white Britons. But Tolson is certainly complex and hyperbolic in his prose, so right. I'd have to look at right. it further.
So there, he's taking a position. Salamisha?
Yeah.
Well, I'm thinking again about like that, because I'm interested in afterlives of people and of objects. And so I'm thinking about, you know, this critique here and the way that he's, the anxiety about it, Churchill co-opting it mm-hmm. in order actually to, as myth tells us, to convince Americans to, you know, become allies with Britain in terms of World War II. So it's not necessarily like a bad use of a poem politically, mm-hmm. even if it disregards the racial climate that the poem's produced in. But I also was thinking that Tolson isn't taking into account the immediate afterlife of the poem, the ways in which African American students were taught this poem and recited as joy or pride, but also as resistance to the state. And so that immediate afterlife, I think, has all of the radical edge that Tolson may have wanted, but has forgotten by the time maybe this Churchill mythology comes mm-hmm. about. I also want to point out that, you know, there are a variety of artistic responses to The Red Summer by African Americans. Right. And Herman's point about this is not a citizenship poem, like it's very different than Du Bois's The Returning Soldiers. Du Bois has this line in this essay, and he says, we return from fighting, we return fighting. And he's really trying to make an appeal for African Americans to claim the mantle of citizenship. I think it's interesting that yeah. McKay's last stand isn't about necessarily joining the United States.
Right.
It's like,
right.
if we
right.
must die, if this is the inevitable outcome of right. racial mm. tension right. in America, this is how we're going to go out. I mean, right. I think that's
right.
such a
yeah.
strategic and insightful and interesting move, and it's very different than many of the African-American writers at
yeah.
the time.
Great.
Though far outnumbered, let us show us brave, and for their thousand blows, deal one death blow. What though before us lies the open grave, like men we'll face the murderers, cowardly pack, pressed to the wall, dying but fighting back.
Well, we could talk a long time more about this poem, and I would enjoy every minute of it, but we have to stop soon. So why don't I ask each of you just to throw out one more idea that might give listeners and readers a chance to go further with this. Who wants to go first? Kathy?
Well, and following up Salamisha's point, I would like to point out that by 1923, the FBI had issued orders to detain Claude McKay from coming back into the U.S. because he's left right after in around 1922. And he's, you know, in traveling throughout Africa. He spends time in Morocco. So the fact that he is intentionally separated from the nation, right, by the FBI putting out orders to all these port cities to not let him back, and that he also can't go back for similar reasons to Jamaica because of his politics, does indicate this kind of last stand that Salamisha is pointing out.
Mm, great. Herm?
Well, you know, I have a friend that uses a phrase he calls risking minstrelsy. I think that the whole Churchill thing, the whole Churchill reading the poem is very much puts us into that territory of Claude McKay risking minstrelsy by adopting this, by using this sonnet form.
And by not having an explicit race marker
right.
in the language of the
right.
poem. Right. So really taking a risk, yeah. Salamisha, last word?
Yeah, well, I think the lack of race marker, I don't know if this is Claude McKay's purpose, but I think one of the things we can take away from it is that the experiences of Black people in the diaspora can be the universal experience. It can be the experience that Churchill can galvanize his nation around and the American nation around. So I think without, you know, saying that Claude McKay's own reading of his poem is right, I think there's a like a radicalness to this that, you know, he may not even have attended, but I think is useful for us to continue to think about.
Great. I guess my final word is to, I'm often very critical of this poem because of its conservative form, apparently conservative form, but I really admire McKay's life living with this poem. By the end of World War II, he was just explicitly proud of the fact that the poem had been unmoored from the 1919 context. Usually we think of unmooring as a dangerous and bad thing for a poem, but he was happy when he found out by listening to the radio that a soldier on the Eastern Front, so that would have to be a Russian, had in his wallet a copy of this poem, a tattered copy of this poem that he read while he was fighting the Nazis. Mm. And McKay reminds us that despite Churchill's thieving here, that the fight against the Nazis was a fight about race, and a different kind of essentialism, that so that he was on the side, and he was long past his communism, but he was on the side of that Russian poet, and he felt proud that he had a little part to play in the soldiering on of this guy who was fighting, you know, the great racism of that time, which of course was Nazism. So I'm excited when I see evidence of that pride by McKay, despite his moving target politics. Mm-hmm. Well, we like to end Poem Talk with a minute or two of Gathering Paradise, which is a chance for several of us, or if you're brief, all of us, to spread wide our narrow hands to gather a little something really poetically good, to hail or commend someone or something going on in the poetry world. Who wants to start and recommend something?
I'll Kathy start. I'm the poetry editor for a journal called The Pinch, which is published by the University of Memphis. It's a national poetry journal, and any poets who are listening should check it out and submit their poems. We're always looking for more poets to add their voices to the journal.
Great. Thank you. Herman Beavers.
I just found out about Yusef Komunyakaa's series of jazz poems dedicated to Charlie Parker, so I strongly recommend that.
Great. Salamisha?
Well, following up that, there's a collection that I really desperately need to read, and I just want to give a shout out to Monica Hand and her collection, Nina and Me. I'm working on a book on Nina Simone, and So I'm enthralled that a contemporary poet has taken up Nina Simone in this form.
That's great. And I'll just shout out to Africana Studies at the University of Pennsylvania and its fabulous leadership, Herman Beavers and others. And it is certainly a program to be looked at, to be clicked on the web, to find out a little more about what's going on here at the University of Pennsylvania and join us. Well, that's all the fighting back we have time for on Poem Talk today. Poem Talk at the Writer's House is a collaboration of the Center for Programs in Contemporary Writing and the Kelly Writer's House at the University of Pennsylvania and the Poetry Foundation, poetryfoundation.org. Thanks to my guests, Herman Beaver, Salamisha Tillett, and Kathy Lou Schultz. And thank you, Kathy Lou, for coming all the way from Memphis to join us. And to Poem Talk's director and engineer today, Zach Cardiner. And to our editor, as always, Steve McLaughlin. Next time on Poem Talk, Danny Snelson, Steve McLaughlin, the aforementioned, and the great Dutch sound poet Jaap Blanc join me to talk about Bob Cobbing's Portrait of Robin Crozier. And after that, Patrick Durgan, Tom Donovan, and Tyrone Williams will be traveling here to join me in a discussion of an improvised word performance by Steve Benson. This is Al Filreis, and I hope you'll join us again soon for those or other episodes of Poem Talk.